Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Single Tracks podcast. My name is Jeff, and today we're going to be talking with bike pack racer Neil Belchenko. Neil holds the record for both the Colorado Trail Race and the Arizona Trail 750, and he's a contributor at bikepacking.com. Neil recently won the Iditarod 350 bikepacking race in Alaska, and he's hosting the second annual bikepacking summit in Gunnison, Colorado this September. Welcome to the show, Neil.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jeff.
So this was your second year competing in the Iditarod 350. Were there things that you learned last year that you were able to carry over into this year's win?
Yeah, so I've kind of been chatting with a bunch of people about this, and really it's so huge to have at least one finish under your belt. There's just little things along the route that you kind of, you know, you gain knowledge of along the way. And even just following somebody that's done the route in the past is huge. So last year, you know, we started off the race. There was like six racers in the lead pack. And basically all I was doing was just kind of observing what they do. You know, a lot of time wasted is in checkpoints. And so kind of figuring out, you know, the best kind of situation when you get into a checkpoint, you take off your clothes, you take off your boots, you put it next to the fire, you eat food right away, you hydrate, you fill up your camelback. All of these things, you know, I learned just by observing what other racers were doing. And so this year, coming back into the race, I was like, all right, well, what can I do to kind of save those minutes and seconds in the checkpoints? And, you know, a lot of things that the guys were doing were, you know, they were doing it swiftly in the checkpoints, but I think I knew I could do things a little bit faster. And so that was like a big goal of mine to just kind of make those checkpoint stops a little bit quicker, because really, you know, you can totally get sucked into being in the warmth and being next to a fire and having a cup of coffee in your hand and drinking a Coke or something like that. So that was a huge, huge lesson that I learned from last year into this year. And then obviously, you know, just knowing the route, knowing what's ahead of you. Sometimes that is, you know, it mentally difficult because you're like, wow, I've got so much ahead of me still. But at the same time, you're like, oh, I recognize that rock, or I recognize that tree or something like that. And you're like, All right, I'm getting closer. I'm getting closer. Like, I know that I'm making progress. And so that's super, super helpful.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I know you're a really competitive person. So when you signed up for the race last year, did you go into it thinking, I'm just here to like check out the race and next year I'm going to really go for it and try to win? Or did you show up that first year kind of hoping that maybe you would win?
No, and that's a really good point. So last year, yeah, I definitely went into the race just wanting to finish. And that's my goal for basically all of these races, just finish. You know, you're up in Alaska, you spend a lot of money to get up there. If you need to get rescued, it's going to be super expensive. So take it slow, or rather slow, and just, you know, focus on the end goal, which is McGrath, which is the finish for us. And so,
yeah.
So coming into it this year, I had definitely a different mindset. I wanted to up the game a little bit. I wanted to, you know, push myself a little bit harder. You know, you do everything you can, whether it's, you know, in the checkpoints or, you know, try to go a little bit faster on the trail or something like that. But yeah, I guess the end goal for me this year was to definitely just make things a little bit swifter. And I think it ended up working out pretty well.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you say too about how the checkpoints are so critical, you know, speeding that up. It reminds me a lot. I mean, I don't know a lot about racing triathlons, but I feel like I've heard triathletes say sort of the same thing, that it's all about your transitions and making that quick and, you know, as efficient as possible. And sounds like maybe that's one of the keys for, at least for bikepacking races like the Iditarod.
Yeah. And I would say especially bikepack races on the snow, winter ultras, fat bike races, just because, you know, you're outside. I think we started this year and it was like 15 degrees. So it wasn't like super, super cold, but it was still chilly, and you're out there and, you know, the condensation from your breath, like, gets on your jersey and on your head, and you still sweat. And so needing to dry those layers off is super, super important. But once you're inside those checkpoints, it's so comfortable. It's warm. It's nice. You're next to a fire. You really do, you know, you really do get sucked in. And a lot of people, you know, kind of in the middle of the pack or the back of the pack, they're like, they do get sucked in. They'll stay there for a night, or they'll be like, wow, I don't know if I want to go on, you know, because they've been there for 2, 3, 4 hours. And they're like, this is nice. This is normal to me, you know? So really just trying to get out of there as soon as possible is really important. And I guess like a good example is the first checkpoint is about, I think it's like 50 miles in or 60 miles in. And I went in, just took my boots off because my boots have studs on the bottom. And so obviously they don't want you to walk around with studs on the bottom, but you take the boots off, take the socks off. I went in, grabbed a cup of soup, had a Coke, filled up my water, and was in and out in like 20, 30 minutes.
Wow.
And then the second checkpoint, which is I think 50 miles beyond that or 60 miles beyond that, Skwetna, that was a little bit longer because there was a nice fire there. I was a little bit, you know, a little bit more wet. The jersey was a little wet. The buff needed to be replaced. So I went in, dropped all my, you know, all my layers, took most of them off down to my bibs, dried everything off, and then got, you know, got some food, got fed, filled up my Camelback, and then was in and out. And I think like maybe an hour. So, and compared to last year, I actually slept in that second aid station. And this year I knew like what I wanted to do is push on to the third checkpoint before I slept. And obviously it's super weather dependent. It could have been snowing really hard, and I would have been like hours and hours behind my time.
Right.
But it was only snowing a little bit, and my splits from last year to this year were actually a little bit slower just because I think we had a little bit softer conditions, but overall they're pretty similar.
Yeah. So, I mean, it sounds like to be a world-class bike pack racer, there are a couple of things you need. One, you need willpower. You need the willpower to like go into one of those checkpoints and drag yourself out as quickly as possible and not get sucked into just sitting there and being comfortable. And then the other is dedication. I mean, for you to, you know, it's not like you just show up for a race, you know, hoping to win. Like this is years in the making oftentimes where you go out, you know, I mean, it takes a lot of planning just to get to the finish line the first time, but once you're there, that's not even the real race. The real race is going to be the next year or the year after that, once you really have done your research and your planning and all that.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And that's exactly what this race was. You know, it was basically 2 years in the making. You know, Arizona Trail Race, when I've done that, I did the Arizona Trail Race 300 before I ever did the Arizona Trail 750. And really, like, a lot of people just jump into, you know, for example, the Tour Divide. And that was like obviously a huge goal of mine when I did the Tour Divide, but I knew that I couldn't just jump into it. I had to train my body. I had to train mentally and just prepare myself for these long days in the saddle. And it's not something you can just do overnight. A lot of people, you know, can do it a little bit easier and quicker, but others, you know, it takes a ton of time. And like I said, the end goal is to finish all of these races. So knowing that I'm mentally and physically prepared before I go into them is super important. And so when I do a new race, or when I do any race, really any bike packing race, I have to be prepared, not only physically, but I have to be right in my head.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure that's a huge part of it. Well, you mentioned the Arizona Trail Race, and that you won that one on, was that your second attempt on that race as well?
So I did the Arizona Trail Race 300. That was like my first bikepacking race. I think it was in 2013, maybe 2012. And then I did it, I think, 2 years later, and I raced the 300, and I raced it to kind of like win it / do as best as I could. I was racing two really super strong athletes in Kurt Refsnyder. And then the 750 came, I think, the following year. And my goal really wasn't to like break the record, but the goal was to win it. I really wanted to push myself and see how I could do. But I hadn't ridden any of the course after that 300-mile course.
Right.
So I really had no idea what to expect, but that was kind of like a blessing because I didn't know what to expect and I just went as hard as I could, you know? And
You rode it like it was the 300, and but for 750 miles.
Yeah, and at the end of the race, I was definitely sleeping a little bit more. So I wanted to actually go back and do that race this year, but I just I don't have enough time for work.
Yeah, well, that was the sort of the question that I was leading up to, which is, do you have a strategy? Like if you do a race like this, like the Iditarod 350, and you win it, or the Arizona 750, where you set the course record. I mean, do you have desire to go back and do those races again, or, you know, keep doing them year after year? Or do you like sort of trying new ones and kind of bagging them as you go?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There's a little piece of me that really wants to go back to the courses that I've had held records at, because I think there's always room for improvement, and records are made to be broken. So eventually they will be, you know.
Right.
And so, yeah, I definitely want to go back to the Arizona Trail Race, because now I know that additional 400 miles. And then, you know, Colorado Trail Race, that's a tough one, because I laid it all on the line from Denver to Durango to set that record.
Yeah.
And so I don't have any intention on going back to do that direction, mm-hmm. but unless the record gets broken, and then maybe I would need to go back and do it. But the Denver to Durango, or the Durango to Denver segment, I'd like to go and race that route again, just because, you know, there's room for improvement. And I think there's at least room for improvement in that direction. So,
yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense, that some races, yeah, you feel like you could have done better. And then other times you put it all out there, and you know, that's the best you can do. And until you can unlock some other secret, or, you know, figure something else out, like, there's really no need to go back and do it. The one thing I will say to give you some encouragement is, we talked to Eddie O'Day on the podcast several months ago, and in doing the research, we found that he holds three bikepacking course records on one of the bikepacking websites. They keep track of that. And as we mentioned at the top of this show, you hold two. So if you could get one more, you could tie the record for the most.
Ah, yeah. Okay. Very good.
And if you get another one, then you will be the one with the most records. So maybe that's something to shoot for.
Well, yeah, that is something to shoot for. I definitely want to actually go out and do the Trans North Georgia. And I think I'm on the roster this year. I just need to figure out the time off. So I that's on the list. And I know Eddie holds that record.
Right. Yeah. Well, you only need to take off a couple of days, because I think that's what the record is.
Right. Right. Yep. Exactly.
Cool. So getting back to the Iditarod, you know, obviously that's a race. It's in Alaska. And because it's a race, you're really focused on staying ahead of the competition for a lot of it, I'm sure. But are there times when you're like out there alone in the wilderness, and do you ever get like worried or scared or anything like that? Or are you just all race mode the whole time?
It's really interesting out there. You go through peaks and valleys, and a lot of those can be avoided those valleys, those down moments can be avoided by chatting with somebody. And so this year's race, I basically was with JP DeVary, who many of you know, super strong ultra endurance athlete.
Yeah.
And I was with him for essentially the first 110, 120 miles.
Nice.
And then, he was doing the 1,000-mile version, so he ended up sleeping in Squetna, where the 350 is more of like a sprint, you know, you go all out.
Right.
And so after I split up with him, I rode alone for the rest of the race. And there was, you know, checkpoint 3, which is called Finger Lake Lodge. And I got there and I started talking to some folks, and I was like, man, I could really, you know, I could use a riding partner. I'd love to chat with somebody. There's this guy, Clinton Hodges, who ended up actually taking second in the 300 race. He was behind me. And I was like, man, I could chat with Clinton, you know, it'd be nice. But but the thing is, you know, there's no way that I was going to wait up for him.
Right.
And that's kind of the interesting dynamic there. And then, you know, another experience on the trail this year, a scary one, was going over Rainy Pass. And if people don't understand like the Iditarod Trail, it's basically a swamp in the summer. And so you can't really travel it at all in the summer.
Okay.
But in the winter, it's just like kind of a frozen, packed down trail. And we really rely on the Iditarod sled dog race because those guys go out and kind of groom the trail and kind of make it actually passable, you know, make water bridges and ice bridges and stuff like that for the dog sled teams. So they go out, you know, a couple weeks in advance and kind of scout the trail and fix it. And especially this section in Rainy Pass, there's a lot that needs to be done because it actually goes through the Alaska Range and it goes over mountains. And so this year, what happened was, you know, the trail was pretty darn good until I got to that point, Rainy Pass area, or just before the pass. And the wind started picking up and it started snowing. And essentially, you know, it was like a full-on blizzard up there. And you wouldn't even be able to see my tracks like probably 10 minutes after I went through because it was just like windy and a ton of snow falling. Eventually, you know, I made it to the top, but, you know, I was going through like avalanche terrain and terrain traps. And it was just like kind of like a little scary for me. It was definitely a moment where I was
just
like,
a little.
Yeah, I was like, you know, this is not smart, you know. And so, you know, you deal with some of those obstacles and those mental hurdles along the way.
Yeah, that seems stressful. I mean, you're constantly weighing like safety and winning a race. But at the end of the day, you know, it's just a race.
It's just a race, exactly.
And it's your life.
It is my life, yeah. So that was definitely probably one of the most scariest moments I've ever had in a race. And who knows, like, I don't even know if the avalanche danger was high. It was dark, you know. I was walking my bike up Rainy Pass, like, you know, sometimes like thigh deep snow because I fell off the trail.
Wow.
Yeah. So there was a lot of variability in the trail this year, and it was just, yeah, it was something else.
Yeah. Do you carry like an avalanche beacon with you? Is that required gear? No.
No, but now I definitely consider it just. If I did get stuck in an avalanche and just to find me, you know,
because,
you know, if you're out there on alone, there's really not much you can do, you know. And a few years back, there was a group of guys that actually, they dealt with a lot more snow, and they were like triggering avalanches and stuff like that. And they turned around.
Oh.
And this year, like I was looking, like I've taken my avalanche level one course. Like I'm privy to the whole avalanche scene, and I know, you know, what to look for and stuff like that. And I wasn't getting any signs of instability or anything like that. I just knew I was in a terrain trap and it was dark.
Right. The darkness seems like that makes it harder to assess the situation.
Exactly. So, yeah, so that was scary, but we made it. And, you know, there's a lot to be said about being up front. You know, you definitely go a little bit faster. You're not chasing anybody, but that you're basically chasing the finish line.
Yeah.
So that was definitely a huge motivator to just keep pushing.
Yeah. What were like the longest stretches where you would go between, you know, houses, or like where you'd at least be near help should you need it?
Yeah. So after Rainy Pass, there's this little checkpoint called Roan, and it's got like a little airstrip, and it's got a national forest cabin. And then for us, there's like a little stand up tent, and it could probably hold, I don't know, anywhere from 10 to 15 people.
Hmm.
So that's our little checkpoint.
Is it manned, or it's just like a shelter in case you need it?
It is. Yeah. There was one person there, and he was sleeping when I got there. I got there at like, I don't know, 3 o'clock in the morning. And this was just on the other side of the Alaskan Range, just on the other side of Rainy Pass. And, you know, when I got there, he was sleeping, and I was like, hey, what's up, Adrian? Because I knew him from last year, super, super nice guy. And he's like, he was surprised to see me. And he you know, he cooked me up some brats. Cause it,
ooh, brats. You know,
every checkpoint gets like a different meal. And we got brats and soup for that one. But, you know, the tent was super cold. The fire wasn't really on. I actually ended up keeping my boots on because I was like, oh, man, this is just...
Well, it's just a tent. You don't have to worry about the floor there.
Right? Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. And so I ended up sleeping there for a little bit. But after Roan, there's a huge stretch. It's about a 70-mile stretch with no aid stations. 70, actually, it's probably closer to 80, 75, 80.
Oh, wow.
From Roan to Nikolai. And the thing is, you know, you could get that done. And if you're doing 10 miles an hour, you can get that done in 7-8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going slow, if it's poor conditions, it's going to take you a while. It could take you a day. And that's basically what ended up happening with me on this stretch. I Roan at like 6 o'clock and 6 a.m. And I got out of like, it's kind of protected by trees. And then you get to this area called the Farewell Burn. And it's this old burn area that's completely exposed. It's like a big swamp, frozen swamp in the winter. And the wind was whipping. That storm that hit Rainy Pass just did a number to the trail. There was no trail really. There was, you know, just, it was blown in.
Yeah.
So it was completely, you know, I couldn't ride it. But then, you know, when I got into like a short section of trees, I could ride that. So that was kind of, you know, that was kind of nice to have. But then I would get back out on to the swamp again and it would be totally windblown and I couldn't ride it. So I was basically walking, you know, anywhere from 1 mile an hour to probably zero, you know, just cause my bike was basically getting stuck in the snow and I had to like pull it out. You know, I couldn't just roll and walk next to it because the front tire would dip down into deep snow. And so I had to like lift the front tire up and like kind of just basically like pull up on my handlebars and just drag my rear wheel.
Ugh.
So I did that for 20 hours on and off until I got to Nikolai. And I was basically like out of food. Like I did not anticipate going that slow in that section. And I got to Nikolai, I think at like 2 a.m. So yeah, that was definitely the longest stretch. But the upside is, you know, Nikolai, it's a small community in interior Alaska. It was a warm checkpoint, and that's the last checkpoint of the race before you get to McGrath. And there's only 50 miles or so after Nikolai to McGrath. So,
oh, nice.
I also knew that I had a decent lead at that point because there's like no cell service out there. There's no Wi-Fi at Roan, so I had no idea where anybody was. But once I got to Nikolai, they showed me the tracker and they told me that I had a pretty decent lead. So I ended up taking a nap there and then pushed on to the finish. Yeah, it was good.
Yeah, but that felt great. So this might be a dumb question, but is the course marked at all or are you relying on GPS to keep you on track?
Yeah, it's a really good question, actually. So like I said, you know, the Iditarod, it's a swamp. It's a frozen swamp. So a lot of times from year to year, the course kind of changes. There's no real way. And typically, you know, it's a way for locals to get, you know, from A to B. And so there's really only one route in the winter. And per the course rules, there's you can actually take any way as long as you travel through certain checkpoints, as long as you travel through Roan, as long as you travel through Nikolai. But really, realistically, there's only one way to go. And so typically it follows, you know, like a somewhat of a trail, like some cut trees, you know, and so there's like reflectors on the trail. But then when you're going over a lake or something like that, you kind of just have to look at the reflectors across the lake, you know, the frozen lake.
Yeah. Yeah. You kind of eyeball where you're heading and try to get there.
Yeah. So yeah, it's actually kind of hard to navigate. Like sometimes you're like, well, do I go this way? And then I do have a GPS. So I look at the GPS and see if it kind of adds up, if it's like, all right, yeah, I think the trail's over here. And you know, I've gotten lost. Like this year I went off route for like a mile and a half cause there was some random trail that some dude made. And then it literally looped back like a, you know, just a loop. Yeah. And I was like, oh, great. So I'm just going to ride this back. And then I like zoomed into my GPS and sure enough, I was completely off trail. And then there's one circumstance on the trail where it's kind of a shortcut. And this year, actually everybody took it, but last year it was kind of half, but in between Nikolai and McGrath, there's a route called the Overland Route and it goes left.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a route that stays on the river that meanders. The Overland Route basically kind of cuts those meanders and it just goes straight to McGrath.
Uh-huh.
Whereas the river meanders and obviously, you know, a meandering river takes up more mileage than a straight line.
Right. But is it maybe less elevation or something? Is it just flat compared to going overland?
It's very little, you know, the meandering river has a tiny less elevation, but it's I think like 4 more miles or something like that.
Oh, wow.
So the overland routes, you know, I didn't know about it last year. I just went the actual Iditarod trail route way and followed my GPS track. And it actually ended up just taking forever. And then This year, I was like, all right, well, I know that there's this other way. And actually more people this year took the other way, like, in, you know, like people from Nikolai to McGrath that were traveling in between on snow machines went this way. So I was like, all right, that's a no-brainer. It's more packed down and it's faster. So that's basically like the only option you have. Otherwise, there's just one way from basically Anchorage to McGrath.
Yeah, that's interesting. So yeah, I'm going to add to our list of skills for world-class bike packers. We got dedication and willpower. I'm going to add confidence too, because I mean, it just sounds like not only do you have to be confident in your physical abilities, your endurance and your strength and preparedness, but like you need to have serious navigation skills. You need to have, you know, wilderness survival skills and all that. And yeah. And then you got to be confident in those skills and know that you've done all your preparation.
Totally. It's a lot of common sense, but yeah, there is a lot that, you know, a lot of my experiences lend to, you know, my success for sure.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about your setup for this particular race. What kind of bike were you riding?
So I was on a Salsa Cycles Muckluck. It's their more expedition style fat bike. It'll hold, you know, 100 millimeter rims, 5-inch tires, and you can actually, with the alternator dropouts on the Muckluck, you can extend the wheelbase, which is super, super helpful for, you know, soft conditions and whatnot. And so, yeah, that was the bike I was on.
What tires were you running?
I was running 45 North Dillinger 5s, studded.
Okay. Wow. And yeah, I mean, you mentioned earlier that you were just sinking through a lot of the snow. So even with 5-inch tires.
Totally. 5-inch tires. I was probably at 2 PSI in some of the softest conditions. I don't really want to go lower than 2 just because I don't want to burp a tire and have to deal with that out there. So if it's 2, I'm going slow enough where I should probably end up walking anyways. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of my thought. And I actually had a PSI indicator in my pocket that whole time, just checking and adding and taking out pressure as needed.
Wow. Would you have run 6-inch tires if there were such a thing?
Probably. Yeah. I mean, I know that a lot of companies are coming out with a little bit bigger rubber right now. And I think I probably could run something slightly larger in the Muckluck, mm-hmm. but I've known the Dillingers, that I've used them for years. The tread pattern and then being able to have studs is huge because, like I said, frozen swamps, there's tons of ice out there.
Yeah.
And when you're riding on rivers, you know, it's basically all ice unless, you know, there's a little bit of snow on top. But this year there's a lot of ice. Yeah. I would say almost as much ice as last year. Last year had a lot more ice, but this year had plenty of ice.
Okay. So how much gear did you actually carry with you for the race? It sounds like the checkpoints were pretty well stocked with hot food and drinks and things like that. And then also, I mean, if you needed to, you could use those as shelters. So did you carry a lot of food or a full shelter with you too?
Yeah. So, you know, you never know what happens out there. You basically have to prepare for the worst.
Right.
So as far as like survival gear, I brought a negative 25 degree sleeping bag and then, you know, a bivy sack and a sleeping pad. And essentially I only used that once just on the other side of Rainy Pass. I was just exhausted. I was like, I was ready to lay down and in the snow and get a few hours of rest.
Yeah.
So I did that, which is kind of exciting, you know, being able to survive out there and use everything you have that you're carrying.
Right.
You know, you could probably rely on checkpoints and sleeping there, but for me, you know, I don't want to have to get sucked in, like I said before, to those checkpoints. So sleeping in the middle of nowhere is kind of a cool thing to do. And it definitely makes for, you know, fast unpack and repack because it's so cold.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. So like, as far as resupply, I carried a ton of food on my bike. But there are, you know, there are checkpoints along the way that have plenty of food. And then you have two drop bags. So like 2-3 weeks before the race, you have to ship two big Ziploc bags essentially with, you know, full of whatever type of food you want up to Anchorage. And then the race directors will drop food in the Finger Lake aid station, which is, I think, like 150 mile or 130 miles in, and then Rhone, which is more or less just beyond the halfway point. So you have the food that you kind of want. Otherwise, they would have, you know, they would be having to haul in just some random food, and they have to, you know, there's no roads up there or anything like that. So they have to, yeah. They have to fly everything in. So that's super, super nice. And then as far as just the other gear that I was carrying, so I was carrying my sleeping system basically in my saddle bag. I had a really small handlebar bag that had essentially just my layers that I could take on and off, things that I probably wouldn't use as often, extra buffs, extra gloves. I actually did have, like, I have some expedition mittens that I had to take out between Nikolai and McGrath, because it went down to like negative 20. And
whoa.
And so I had basically all my layers on, you know, my down coat that I had in my frame bag and my rain jacket to kind of act as a vapor barrier and hold that moisture in. And then I had my down gloves inside my pogies. And then I like ripped open a bunch of hand warmers as well. I carry a bunch of hand warmers. So yeah, I mean, basically it's a lot of just kind of experience on my packing system, just like what I've used in the past and stuff. Yeah, I guess that I would say that's probably the most important thing, is that the experience as far as my packing and is concerned. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What did the whole thing end up weighing? Did you weigh it before the race?
I did, of 48 pounds. So
wow.
Yeah. So it actually wasn't, you know, it wasn't as bad as it could have been, considering, you know, fat bikes are kind of heavy anyways. You got, you know, a lot of rubber on them and just the rims are heavier and everything like that.
Yeah. And it's winter. So it's not like, you know, you're just packing tank tops and short shorts.
Exactly. Yeah. And so as far as like water is concerned too, I didn't bring this up, you know, your Camelback freezes really quickly if it's just on the outside. So what basically all of us winter ultra riders do is we put it underneath all of our layers and then layer over that.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what I did for this year again. And so at least I don't have, you know, a ton of water on my bike, because it would freeze and it would be dead weight instantly.
Yeah.
So the only way to keep that liquid in liquid form is to keep it on my back. And then I would have to, like, every single time I would sip into some water, I'd have to blow back into the bladder to make sure that the hose doesn't freeze, because that's even right. That's the worst, you know, just
yeah.
If the hose is frozen. So
yeah.
Yeah. Just a ton of just small things that you get from experience.
Yeah, that's great. Great tips. So Neil, I wanted to ask you about some of the differences between competing in a winter race like the Iditarod and more the like deserty, you know, summer races like the Arizona Trail and the Colorado Trail races. Do you have a preference for one or the other? Are there unique challenges or things that maybe you're uniquely suited for, you think?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think more recently, I've become more drawn to the winter ultras because there's a lot more unknowns dealing with, you know, negative degree temperatures and snow, and just like basically you're more on a survival mission than anything else. And that's kind of a draw. But at the same time, it's really hard to beat, you know, especially the first 300 miles of the Arizona Trail Race. It's just beautiful. You're in shorts and a t-shirt. Yeah. I mean, my preference right now, it would be winter ultras, but now that we're getting closer to, you know, to summer, obviously I'm looking forward to the summer events for sure.
Yeah. It seems to me, I mean, for me personally, I feel like I would have a harder time with the summer events actually, because, you know, feel like you'd be sweating a lot more. Hydration would be more of an issue than in the winter race. Have you found that to be the case, or are winter ones, is hydration equally important because it's so dry wherever you're competing?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Actually, the Arizona Trail Race, you're losing so much moisture through the sweat because it is so hot. Whereas, like, probably got away with 2-3 liters, drinking 3 liters over 20 hours and 70 miles from Rhone to Nikolai. So
that doesn't sound like a lot.
Yeah, it's definitely not. So yeah, I would say as far as that's concerned, that's definitely more of a challenge. And obviously, you know, a big difference is the technical level of the trail. You know, the Arizona Trail Race, you're going over rocks and tight and twisty turns, and you're on a full on mountain bike single track trail. Whereas, you know, the Iditarod or any of these winter ultras are typically on groomed roads or trails that are packed down for the most part. And so you're not really, other than trying to stay on your bike through deep snow, you're not really, you know, you need balance for that. You're not really on too much of a technical trail, other than, you know, there are some spots on the Iditarod that are super steep and downhill, uphill, but for the most part, for the majority of the trail, it's actually pretty straightforward, pretty easy trail.
Yeah. I don't know. You got me starting to think maybe winter bikepacking races are the thing to do. Cause I mean, my other problem is you can always put on more clothes, but if you're hot, there's not much you can do to cool yourself down anymore aside from riding in the buff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like dumping water on yourself if you have it.
Right. Yeah. Right. If you can spare it. So you live in Crested Butte, Colorado, which, you know, people will like save up their whole lives to be able to go and spend like a week there riding their mountain bikes. Are you able to get out and ride much for fun, or are you always, you know, loading your bike down with heavy weights and stuff to go for training rides?
No, yeah, I'm all about having fun. I love where I live. You know, I'm definitely pretty lucky to live here. Obviously, it's not easy, you know, making it work in a tourist resort town, but we do it. And when we can, when we can go have fun, we go have fun. And so I hardly ever weigh my bike down other than, you know, maybe 2-3 weeks in advance. Otherwise, you know, I'm going out for, you know, fun rides and training rides are still super fun rides. And really all my bikepacking races are fun rides other than, you know, those peaks there, you know, those valleys. But yeah, I mean, I'm super, super lucky. I'm looking outside at Mount Crested Butte right now, and it's still ski season here, but we've kind of had a poor winter. So we're going to be riding a single track up here in no time.
Yeah. Do you have like a full suspension or a trail bike, or all your bikes, you know, more geared for bikepacking?
Well, so Salsa is a huge partner of mine, and obviously, you know, they have the Adventure by Bike bikes scene down. You know, they make great race bikes and adventure bikes, but they also make some fun trail bikes, like the Salsa Cycles Red Point, which I am lucky enough to be getting one this year. So I haven't been on it other than testing it. But yeah, it's like a 160, 150 rear trail bike, and it's going to eat up the trails around here. It's going to be a lot of fun. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that. And it's kind of new. Like, I've always been on either like a super fast hardtail, or, you know, like the Salsa Spearfish, which is just their like cross country endurance rig. So, this will be a nice change for me this year. And, I'll definitely be able to enjoy some of these downhills in Crested Butte a little bit more.
Yeah. Nice. So are you able, I mean, does this training take up a lot of time? I mean, you look at a race, and in a race you're riding 100 miles or more in a day. So how do you even train for that? Is it really time consuming? Do you have to go out for, you know, a 90 mile ride to get ready for a bikepacking race?
So no, I don't. Luckily, so I maybe this is my thought process. Everybody's a little different, but I've been doing this for a while. I have, you know, the bikepacking form, so to speak. You know, I know what my body can handle when I get to these bikepacking races. So really just like putting in, you know, 5-6 hour days before, you know, right before a race, those are like the most important, like trying to figure out how my body reacts, when I need to, you know, start putting, you know, calories in my body. But really what I do is like 4 rides a week or so. And this is kind of in the summer. In the winter, it's really difficult because of the snow here. But in the summer, you know, I'm doing like hour and a half rides, and then I'll do like a weekend ride that's like 3-4 hours, and then sometimes I'll do like a 5-6 hour ride. So I'm not like riding my bike a ton. I think the most important thing for these big long races is to actually have a rested body. So the most important thing for me before a race is to be getting like 8-9 hours of sleep a night to just ensure that my muscles are recovered.
Yeah. And so I mean, just to be clear, like bikepacking, that's not like your day job, right? Like you don't spend all your days just riding your bike. So yeah, what do you do in the daytime when you're not bikepacking?
Yeah. So I work for a company called Irwin Guides, and essentially it's a guiding company in Crested Butte, and we offer, you know, guided mountain bike experiences, overnight mountain bike experiences, mountain bike clinics, maybe potentially a bikepacking trip in the future. Now that I'm working there, we'll see. but we also sell, like, you know, guided rock climbing trips, fly fishing, cat skiing, backcountry skiing. It's a fun job. I work in the office. I work with a bunch of good people, a bunch of awesome guides. And it's a little bit new. It's a new kind of situation for me because I now have, like, you know, vacation time that I have to use. And so I don't get as much time off as I would like for these bike packing trips. So what I have to kind of do now is just focus on some shorter rides. So, like, obviously shorter bike packing events, you know, the Iditarod. I'm going to go line up in the Arizona Trail Race in 2 weeks. And then, you know, I think the Trans North Georgia in August. So these are all just kind of weekend rides, but they're still big undertakings. They're just shorter than the Tour Divide, shorter than the full Arizona Trail Race, things like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, your story though should at least be encouraging for others who want to get into bikepacking, maybe even not at the competitive level, people who just want to do it because it's really fun and it doesn't take all your time. You can work a regular job and still have plenty of time to do it. And you're showing you have time to dominate at it. So that's really awesome.
I do a ton of racing, but I also do a ton of, you know, just overnighters. And I kind of just look at the weather. And if it's nice out for the weekend, I'll just go out with my wife, Lindsay, and we'll just go for a quick overnighter and enjoy ourselves. Like, I love racing, but I think the whole bikepacking thing is, you know, the real takeaway from bikepacking is just, like, go slow, enjoy your natural surroundings and live off your bike. And I love doing that.
Yeah, that's great. This summer, you're hosting the second annual bikepacking summit in Gunnison in September, I believe. So who is this event geared toward primarily? What's sort of the idea behind the summit?
Yeah, so we're hosting our second annual bikepacking summit, September 14th through 16th, and it's actually going to be in Gunnison, Colorado. And last year we held it in Golden, which was a great venue. We held it at New Train Brewing Company, but this year we kind of wanted to make it more of like a destination. And a lot of people, maybe a lot of people don't know about Gunnison, but it's 30 miles south of Crested Butte. It's kind of our neighboring town in the Gunnison County here. And it's got tons of awesome single track and dirt roads and just endless bikepacking options. So we were like, this is a no-brainer for us to move it to Gunnison. Obviously, it's closer to our home as well. So we're catering it towards, you know, people that are everybody, really. You know, people that haven't even bikepacked yet that are looking to gain the knowledge to kind of take that next step to get out and do an overnighter, all the way to, you know, racers or people that are touring the world that want to learn some more or share their knowledge. But yeah, essentially it's just 3 days of riding, storytelling, and community building.
Yeah, that's cool. Is it part of it industry as well? Are there companies that are going to be involved in showing off products, or are there like advocacy type things that the bikepacking community is working on or that would be part of a summit like that?
Yeah, totally. So that's the big thing, you know, trail advocacy, land use issues. So we're bringing in Kurt Refsnyder, who is the president of Bikepacking Roots and the founder. He's gonna talk about, you know, the issues that we've got going on with the trail advocacies and all of that. And then, you know, we're going to bring in some more people. Hopefully we're obviously still dialing in our presenters and partners and everything, but bring in more people that are privy to those issues in the United States and beyond, really. And then, as far as, you know, our partners, we're definitely keeping it small to start because we want to we want to make it successful for the future. And so we'll definitely have, you know, vendors there that will be showcasing products. We'll have bike demos where you can, you know, we'll have group rides so you can demo a bike for a day. And then before and after, I think the plan is before we're going to do before the event, we're going to do an overnighter, and it'll be open to anybody. And then afterwards, our county commissioner, Jonathan Houck, who's a super awesome guy, family man, but he's also a bike packer. He has developed a route in the Gunnison County that basically circumnavigates the whole county.
Oh, wow.
So it connects like Crested Butte, Gunnison, Pitkin, Marble, a few other towns. And I think after the summit, we're going to go and kind of tour this route, and it'll probably take, you know, quite a few days, 5-6 days, but, it should be a really cool experience and showcase the beauty of Gunnison County.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, one issue I wanted to ask you about is bikes in wilderness. Is that an issue that you see the bikepacking community taking up? Is it controversial among bike packers as it is among regular mountain bikers?
You know, I don't think so. I think we have plenty of, personally, you know, I want a bike everywhere, but I understand where people are coming from, as far as, you know, keeping wilderness areas bike free. I think we have tons of bikeable terrain already. So I'm not one to kind of argue for or against it, but I think that'll definitely come up throughout the weekend. I don't see why not. And I think personally here in Gunnison County, there's a ton of wilderness that if we didn't have it, we could make even better loops. But at the same time, I understand why it's there.
Yeah, that's a great answer. So how can people learn more about the Bikepacking Summit or register for it?
Yeah, so head over to bikepackingsummit.com. Actually today, which is what we're April or March 21st, I've got a ton of work to do for dialing in presenters and everything like that. I've got a bunch of emails to answer, but we definitely know Kurt Refsnyder is going to be here and a bunch of other trail advocacy people and brands and whatnot. But yeah, head over to the website. There's a link to register on the homepage, and there's also a contact form on our website. If you have any questions, definitely feel free to hit us up.
Awesome. Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Neil. This has been really entertaining, and I definitely have learned a lot about bikepacking. So yeah, thanks again for joining us.
Awesome. Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, if you're enjoying the Single Tracks podcast, be sure to rate us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. That's all we've got this week. We'll talk to you again next week. Peace.